In this episode of the Project Management Podcast, you learn how to maximize your project's first 21 days and avoid some of the common startup mistakes. Hello and welcome to the Project Management Podcast at pm-podcast.com. I'm Cornelius Fichtner. We are coming to you live from the Connecting 2018 PMI Global Conference in Los Angeles, California. And with me right now is Sarah Gallagher.
Hello.
Good afternoon and welcome back.
Thank you so much.
This is our second conference interview.
It is, yes.
Yeah. So will you be presenting next year?
I hope so.
Oh,
I hope to present every year because it is such a fun experience to come back year after year and see some of the same people over and over again.
What do you get out of it?
I get a lot. Number one, I obviously get the PDUs that everybody else gets, right? But more importantly, you know, I always leave every day of the conference with at least a couple of aha moments, something that just makes me think about my own project management practice in a new way. And I always leave with new friends.
The adjective that I used, we're coming to you live from the Connecting 2018 Global Conference, that adjective is from you.
Yes.
Tell me, why did you choose connective?
When I come to the PMI conference, I always feel that I make really meaningful professional relationships, but also friends. You know, I meet people from all over the world. I meet people from different industries. I meet fellow consultants who it's always so fun to chat with about how they approach their work, how you help people solve their project problems. So I just love it.
Mm-hmm. And to everybody out there who is not here, that's what you are missing. Your presentation is called Win the Battle Before It Begins, How to Maximize the First 21 Days. Why 21 days? And is it business days or are we actually talking, you know, 3 weeks, calendar weeks?
So the number 21 has a special significance to me, and it's the story that I open the presentation with. It is an arbitrary number. What I'm really talking about is the first, let's say, 10% of whatever your project length is, which is when you're building trust with the team, when you're scoping out your project, you're framing it up, you're making sure everyone understands the why of the project that you're doing. So for long projects, that might be more like 45 days. You know, for short projects, I used a length of, let's say, about a year. So 21 days is kind of how I arrived at that number. But for me, the story comes from the very first project that I ever managed.
Oh, okay. You mentioned it. We have to follow up on it.
Okay.
Please tell us more about that.
So I worked for a really wonderful educational institution that was responsible for training and retraining adults in Oklahoma, the state where I'm from. So people would come to us to learn how to be a welder or a cosmetologist or a medical assistant, right? And I went to work for them in 2008. So if you'll remember, that is the year of one of the greatest recessions to hit in a long time. And what do people do whenever there's a recession? They go back to school. Right? They retrain or they train themselves in a field that's in demand or try to sit out the market for a year or two until the opportunities open up. So our institution had always enjoyed really great student retention and job placement rates. When that recession hit and we got hit with an influx of students, it became really difficult to manage that new student volume. So the CEO comes to me and she says, Sarah, here's your project. I need you. You've got 18 months. I need you to get our student retention percentage up to pre-2008 levels. I need you to do it in 18 months. And I need you to figure out how to do it. You tell me what the scope of the project is going to be. So when we say a project is a service, product, or result, this was a clear result-oriented project, and I was scared to death. I mean, this was a project I really had no business managing, probably with my current level of experience.
Most first projects we have no business
exactly.
managing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So then she added something. She said, Sarah, I have already taken the liberty of meeting with the department heads and the executives. And we all agree that where we're really seeing a problem is that students are actually getting all the way to about, you know, week 30 of a 33-week program. And that's when they're quitting. They're quitting 3 weeks before graduation, which is insane, right?
Yeah.
And so she said, I want whatever you do to focus on the last 3 to 4 weeks of a student's program. So I said, great, I'm on it, boss, right? So we go in, we invest in staff, we invest in new processes, we upgrade our software, we figure out what we've got to do to hit those students in the last 3 to 4 weeks. Okay, 6 months goes by. Director of accreditation happens to be a friend of mine. She comes to me and she pulls the latest retention numbers. Not only have they not improved, they've gotten worse.
I think I can see where this is going, in particular with the title of your presentation here.
Yes. Yeah. And so what my friend came to me with was some data that suggested we had been completely wrong about students graduating at the end of their program. In fact, nearly 40% of all drops were occurring in the first 21 days of a student's program. And 75% of our drops were occurring in the first half of a student's program. And again, an average program was about 35 weeks.
So you had to focus not on the end, you had to focus on the beginning.
Exactly. And so this presentation was really born out of my most painful moments as a PM, starting with that very first mistake, right? Of not doing my own assumptions validation in the beginning. But I started to wonder, is there something to this 21-day thing that doesn't just apply to students, but applies to anything we do, project, a goal that we're trying to do for the first time, that those first few weeks are disproportionately more important than the rest? And as it turns out, as I started to practice project management for many years after that and do research, I started to see there is actually a lot of support for the fact that those first 21 days really matter. Mm-hmm.
One of your slides in the presentation talks about, you know, where do failures occur? Mm-hmm. What areas do failures occur? I know you're presenting this only, you know, tomorrow, mm-hmm. but what do you expect the answer is going to be? What is your current data show you? Where do failures occur?
Well, PMI does a study every year, as I'm sure you know, called Pulse of the Profession. Mm-hmm. And I follow it pretty closely. It's a survey of 5,000 practicing project management professionals. Not necessarily all certified project management professionals, but they ask that exact question. They ask what percentage of projects fail to meet their original intent. And of course, we found that 69% do meet their original intent and almost a full third do not, which is incredible to me. So then there's a follow-up question that says, okay, what are the top reasons for projects that are deemed failures? And what we find is this list of, let's say, you know, the top 10 reasons, and they all have to do with things like change in project objectives, inaccurate requirements gathering, bad vision or goal for the project, right? So what do all these things have in common? Well, to me, they're all things that we try to address early in the project as we're framing it up. The other thing that always strikes me, and this data, by the way, is consistent year after year. That number hovers right around that 69%, and those reasons stay pretty much in that same order. It shocks me because, for example, you know, unclear roles and responsibilities. Well, we've got tools for that, right? We've got our RACI matrices. We've got our work breakdown structures. We've got all these things, and yet we're still struggling. And so I really wanted to know, why is that? And that's really where this talk goes.
Mm-hmm. And before we can really continue, we have to talk about four words that you use mm-hmm. in the presentation: map building and wilderness survival.
Yes. So I love this phrase, the map is not the terrain. And to me, what that means is, you know, as PMs, especially in the first few weeks of a project, we spend a lot of time trying to build a map of where we're going. We call that map a charter, and we call that map a project management plan, right? And so like my husband, for example, he can always tell when I'm starting a project because I virtually disappear for four weeks, right? You are so consumed with trying to get all this paperwork done and all these meetings held and, you know, all the stakeholders to get their input. And it's just so consuming. And I think, though, that we get then so attached to the map that we build. So we're walking along and we see a mountain where we didn't think a mountain should be. It's not on our map. Rather than redraw the map at that point, most of us, metaphorically speaking, will sit there and argue with that mountain why it shouldn't be there. Because we're so married to that map. And so for me, I started to think less in terms of building a perfect map and more in terms of how can we use that first 21 days to actually get our team ready for the wilderness, ready for the real terrain that we're going to find.
Not what
when
it says in the project
this.
Management plan, but what you will actually encounter
right,
out there.
Right, exactly. You know, I hesitate to say this because I do see a lot of value in things like the RACI matrix, for example. Particularly when you're first starting a project and you're trying to get a handle on, especially for deliverables, who needs to approve something, right? Who needs to be consulted, that type of thing. But in my experience, when you're right in the thick of it and there is a question about something that needs to get done and it falls right in the middle of maybe what could be three different people's job, no one says at that point, hang on, let's just consult our RACI matrix. You know, I've not once seen that happen in a meeting where everybody's like, hold on, I got this. They whip out that RACI matrix and all of a sudden, you know, all is clear, right? Instead, it usually comes down to real, honest, targeted, collaborative conversation. And if you haven't spent those first 21 days building that kind of clarity, that kind of relationship, that kind of communication, then, you know, that RACI matrix isn't going to help you. So a lot of this talk is, it's not throwing out the tools, but it's realizing the many ways and interesting ways in which those tools get in our way and how they obscure the real point of the exercise.
What I often noticed in the past is that when you have a PMO or some prescriptive methodology, it has templates attached and project managers seem to be just following the rules. And, you know, mm-hmm. this is a box mm-hmm. I have to check. This is something I have to fill something in. Instead of realizing this is just a tool allowing me to start a conversation with my stakeholders, with my clients, with the team members, with the people on my team. Is that kind of a similar
Absolutely.
Way of looking at it?
And here's an example of that I see constantly. It's when you set a well-intentioned rule that backfires. I know a lot of companies that tell PMs one of the first things that they have to do before they can get their charter or their project management plan approved is they have to document their top 10 project risks, right? And I've seen this over and over again. And so, and they either have to do that by attaching a risk register or by listing them out in the charter. PMs can get so bogged down in trying to complete that activity of getting those top 10 risks that they don't actually sit and have a deep, focused, critical conversation with their team about the real risks facing their project. In other words, it becomes a check the box activity and not a real conversation.
We just have to have 10.
Yeah.
which 10 will we take?
Exactly. And yeah, they get hung up on that number. Well, what if there's actually 15, you know, that we need to plan for? What if there's only really 5? You know, I've really seen that, but you know, it definitely anchors you to a nonsensical, arbitrary number, as well as a document that you may or may not pick up again, you know? And I've seen that, unfortunately, where a lot of documents just collect digital dust on SharePoint somewhere, right? Yeah. And so I do believe in documentation. I think it can be very powerful, but I think that you have to balance that with the real purpose of what you're trying to do.
Let me quickly rewind to day zero of all of this, because you mentioned a project charter at one point. So are you talking the first 21 days after the project has been initiated and is formally approved? Or are we talking about just 21 days in the, you know, starting it up, charter, get it approved, that time?
So in the PMBOK world, I would say in general, I'm talking about day zero being after your charter is signed.
Yeah.
That said, I'm a consultant. I work with lots and lots of companies. The trend that I have seen, for better or worse, is that a lot of companies are blending the initiating and the planning process groups, right? And some of them by necessity, because if you have a 3-month project, right, it may not make sense. And that's why we now have tailoring, the concept of tailoring in the 6th edition, right? It may not make sense to go through a long charter exercise and turn around and expand that into a project management plan. So, you know, that first 21 days to me, the important things that mark it are, it's the time period in which you are meeting your team for the first time. You are establishing roles and responsibilities. You are figuring out what done looks like for your project and what the scope is, right? You're getting in touch with the why of your project in clearer terms than probably what the charter would typically outline, because so little is known at the time that you do your charter.
Mm-hmm. You, in your presentation, look at five specific areas that we should be looking at in those 21 days. Business case, scope, baseline, budget and schedule, roles and responsibilities, and the communication plan. Mm-hmm. From your experience, which of these five is usually the hardest for us project managers to really and seriously define and say, okay, we got this?
Well, I think they're all very difficult to define. And I think that, you know, the key theme of what I talk about is the difference between, so using that phrase, the map is not the terrain, mm-hmm. right? The difference between approaching these things from a map building perspective. So let me talk about map building. Map building for a scope baseline looks like you have a detailed work breakdown structure, mm-hmm. right? Map building for roles and responsibilities is I either have very good role descriptions, narrative format, or I've got a RACI matrix or both. Okay. Terrain preparation, wilderness preparation goes beyond that to the heart of what you're really trying to do. And I would say that that wilderness preparation principle is what we base our tailoring off of, right? So when PMI has now entered this element of flexibility in the tailoring, right? Well, how do you know what's right for your project? You have to cut to the heart of it, that wilderness preparation thing. So let's take roles and responsibilities, right? That's a great one. So as I said, that RACI matrix, it's useful, especially in the beginning of the project. Sometimes I feel like it's more useful to the PM who's trying to grapple with all the moving parts than it is to the team as a whole. But your RACI matrix isn't any good if your team doesn't really understand member by member, if they can't articulate what are they there to do and how does their role relate to everybody else, right? So for me, let me tell you the thing that's added more value to me as a PM, as a practice, than any RACI matrix I've ever done. In the kickoff meeting, right? You're doing introductions. One of the things that I do as a PM is I say, now, as you go around and introduce yourself, this is like the core team, let's say 10 to 15 core people, right? Tell us in a couple of sentences what you see as your role on this project and what the rest of us can do to help you be successful in that role. That prompt elicits such amazing conversation around the table that carries us through the rest of the project. And then as a PM, right, as they're doing that, I'm also facilitating. So someone says, well, I think my role is to really make sure that the business requirements reflect what we're hearing from stakeholders. So I, as a PM, can say, oh, Bob, that's great. I heard Susan say that she also felt that there was an element of her role that does the same thing. What do you guys see as the overlap between you? What do you see as the differences between your roles? Right. And we can have that conversation just 15 to 20 minutes and have clarity that a RACI matrix for me has never been able to achieve.
How do we project managers go from, oh, I have to fill in the RACI mm-hmm. matrix mm-hmm. to that kind of a situation where we have a valuable conversation with our project teams that leads to success?
So for me, you know, you put first things first. To me, that conversation should happen first. And I always bring in a scribe who's furiously typing what people are saying, right? And then that can become the document that I use to draft a RACI, right? Here's what I heard from all of you. Here's the role description. Here's what you guys told me. Here's the RACI that I've built based on that. Let me know if this looks appropriate based on our conversation. So in other words, that conversation is the central thing. The RACI comes after, as opposed to what I think a lot of PMs do, which is they try to get that RACI out there. And then if they've got time, they have that conversation. Mm-hmm.
So we talked about the RACI, so the roles and responsibilities. Let's go to the first two, maybe.
Okay, sure. Absolutely.
No, that's fine. That's perfectly okay. because to me, that was eye-opening, just to be clear. The first one is defining and communicating the business case. Mm-hmm. So what do you do differently in order to do this for the terrain and not for the map?
So I think there's two things that I talk about here. The first one is, so I'm a consultant, right? And I can't tell you the number of times this happens to me where I have a PM call me, let's say for a software project. They're about a month away from going live. They call me and they say, hey, we're about a month from deployment. I think it's probably about time we start thinking about our deployment and change management strategy. Can you help? 30 days to go, right?
A little late, yeah.
A little late. But so often this happens.
I've done
it. Yeah, absolutely. It's an afterthought, right? But I think that those first 21 days can be so useful in starting to lay that groundwork of getting that change story defined and bought into by everybody, so that that work of communicating what's coming and what it will look like and how it will impact you is happening throughout the project as opposed to at the very end, which gives people time to adjust. You know, if you wait to even have that conversation until a month before go live, then you go live, people are still at that, you know, that sort of confusion and concern stage of the change journey, right? And you don't want to go live when people are in the confusion and the concern stage. So that's the first thing. The second thing that I've seen is that people arbitrarily decide from the top down what the change story should be. There's a really famous behavioral experiment where half of the participants are given lottery tickets with arbitrary numbers printed on them. The other half of the room is allowed to select their own lottery ticket numbers. And then the researchers, right before the winning numbers are drawn, offer to buy back the tickets. The people that chose their own lottery numbers, right, they ask for 5 times more money for their tickets than those that just receive numbers. And to me, this has amazing implications for how we approach the change journey, because, you know, when people are told their talking points, when they're told why they should like something, or else, usually, right? It doesn't matter how many road shows you do, how great your PowerPoint presentation is, you're not going to get people there. And so I think, you know, your change journey in those first 21 days has to start with a lot of listening. And as a consultant, you know, before I ever present recommendations or a roadmap of what I think a client should do, I almost always frame it in terms of, so when we spoke to you, you told us X, you told us Y, and it's because of that that we're suggesting Z, as opposed to, well, according to best practice, here's where you are and here's where you need to be. You know, when people have their own words fed back to them, they are more bought in. And I think that that's something we can apply to projects in general.
Out of the 5 that you have listed here, I'd like to talk about one more.
Okay.
And that's the scope baseline, establishing the scope baseline. Because to me, that's kind of a doozy. I mean, without having the scope, without knowing what it is that we deliver, but we don't really have a project.
Yeah.
So what do you do different here in terms of the WBS, the scope definition? How do you make sure it's ready for the terrain and not just a map?
So here, what I actually add something to the things that you would normally do, right? So we normally would do a WBS, maybe a scope description, something like that. I make sure that we've defined what done looks like. This is a concept that comes from Agile, right? And I'm a big believer that even if you're in a traditional project management environment, there's so much that we can take from the way that Agile is teaching us to work with people. So definition of done just says, you know, if you don't have a clearly defined, agreed upon baseline for what finished looks like, what's the criteria for everyone being able to pack up their stuff and go home? If you don't have that, guess what happens? Everyone fills in their own definition, you know? So one of the things I love to see in schedules, I say the word love ironically, is charter completed. Okay, well, what the heck does completed mean, right? Does that mean it's drafted? Does that mean it's been submitted? Does that mean it's under review? Does that mean it's been approved? And if so, approved by whom, you know? So for me, when you don't have a clearly defined definition of when the project team really can pack up their stuff and go home, then you will, number one, have everybody come up with their own definition, which is where a lot of communication confusion happens. And number two, you risk not achieving the value that you set out to achieve. So in the IT world, done is often the system is live. Okay. But what if done is also that our users are trained, that people are actually using the system, that we have for a 60-day window worked hand in hand with operations to support that system and make sure that what we delivered is correct, that our software has been archived and documented. Those things that we think of as afterthoughts, they have to be in your definition of done so that everyone knows what success is.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'd like to do a mental exercise with you.
Got it.
Right. Time capsule. You know what that is, right?
Okay,
you take stuff, you put it into it, you bury it in the ground, and then 50 years from now, open it up again, and you read those great things that we put in there.
Yes.
Now, my time capsule is somewhat different. It's sort of a science fiction time capsule. it goes back in time.
Okay.
All right. So, and this time capsule goes back in time to a younger you.
Okay.
To your very first project.
Okay.
Okay. So, you have one page of writing something down for yourself, and your younger self will open it up and will be able to learn from you now. What do you tell your younger self?
Oh, my goodness.
You're just starting out your first project back then. What do you tell yourself?
First thing I tell myself is to remember to breathe. And I don't mean that too facetiously, because I have learned a lot about the power of breathing, you know, and the ability to get oxygen to that prefrontal cortex where your judgment lives, right? When you allow yourself to be overwhelmed by the stress and you stop breathing, you also stop making good decisions. So I think that is one of the key tools that I've learned in the last couple of years. Another thing I would teach myself, this is very geared towards me being my personality and myself, right? Is as quickly as you can, stop saying I, start saying we. This is actually advice that my first boss gave me, and it's carried me through a long time. I was definitely an introvert type of person and a very, you know, achievement focus driven kind of person right out of college. And it didn't occur to me to think of myself as part of a team, which I can laugh about now. But at the time I was very, you know, I liked imposing order on chaos. And I use that verb imposing very purposefully because I imposed, you know, I stepped on who I needed to step on to make sure that the team was successful, but without bringing the team along with me. I think that's why so much of my work now focuses on this unsticking troubled projects through people aspect. Because I was not good at it when I first graduated and probably like many 20 somethings, you know. So I would probably give myself that advice. And then the third thing I would tell myself is relentlessly focus on identifying what matters and leave the rest alone. I think that, which is really the point of this talk, right, is get to the heart of what your team needs to do next to succeed. And don't worry about, you know, filling out reams of paperwork because you thought that the PMBOK told you to. You know, I remember I wasn't trained by in my first job. There was no other PM I was at, right? I had no one to really train me. When I first learned that a PMBOK existed, a PMBOK guide, it was like a halo over that book, right? And I grabbed it and you know, it's not like thrilling reading, but I grabbed it. I must have read it 6 times in 6 months, thinking it held all the answers, you know. And it was such a great starting place. Like I actually really like the PMBOK guide in terms of its ability to really orient you in the profession. But I also really thought it meant I had to do all the things. You know, I had to have the RACI, the work breakdown structure, the charter, the project management plan, but also all of the component plans of the project management plan, right? Meanwhile, I'm working on a 2-month project. So I think, you know, it's just that judgment and the balance and all of that. So I would have told myself that as well.
All right. Back to the present.
Okay.
The first 21 days. What have you found is the hardest thing to get across to your team in regards to, you know, we're planning for the terrain for just creating the map?
Oh, so here's what I've found is most difficult in those first few days is you are trying to do a lot of planning and estimating of standards you will later be held accountable to, right? So for example, you're asking the team to give you estimates on how long certain tasks are going to take. We also know that all teams go through certain stages of effectiveness, right? The whole forming, storming, norming, all that stuff, right? The team is squarely in the middle of forming / storming in the first 21 days of your project. And that also is the time when you're trying to establish baselines against which you're going to be held accountable for the rest of the project.
So a group of people who doesn't yet really work well together has to do something that their future selves are going to be held accountable against.
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
We get, you know, padded estimates and how we get lots of confusion about what, you know, what do you mean when you say X or Y in the charter or the project management plan? So for me, this is why it's baffling to me how much of an afterthought team building is in so many organizations in those first, 21 days. And I'm not saying that you have to go, pay to take your entire team to a rustic lodge and do a ropes course in trust falls for a weekend, right? That doesn't have to be what that team building looks like, but we have to pay attention to it. Otherwise, you're going to get bad estimates. Otherwise, you're going to get confusion. Otherwise, you're going to get people that, have so much conflict in the beginning that when you get into execution, they're still not over it. So for me, that is so huge.
Why did you decide to do this particular presentation? What is the one thing that you started out with saying, I have to get this one across? This is the one thing that people have to know.
So I have the great opportunity as a consultant to work with project managers and executives across a number of industries of varying project lengths. And I also, late this year, took on a new role, which has me leading other project managers and consulting project managers. And so I've been watching, so your time capsule question, right? I'm watching them 10, 15 years behind me managing their first projects and not knowing where to begin or feeling that pressure of, I've got to get all this paperwork done, and they're missing the point, right? They're missing important things. And as I'm watching this, I don't know if these ideas really started to crystallize for me. And at the same time, I was experimenting with new approaches. So in my own practice, I was thinking, okay, I don't want to throw the RACI matrix out. It adds value, especially to me as a PM, to be able to understand and have some documentation around who needs to be involved in what, but it's also not cutting it. So what could work instead, right? And so I like to treat my own project management practice a little bit like a science lab. And I was having a lot of breakthroughs just myself and how to get these projects off on the right foot. And so, yeah, this presentation came out of that experience.
Mm-hmm. So if our listeners now feel, we need help. We definitely need help. We need Sarah. We need her team.
Absolutely.
How do they get in touch with you? Where can they find you?
So my favorite place to connect with people is on LinkedIn.
Okay.
I just think that's a great, because we can stay in touch if you move companies, if you move states, right? As long as your profile is updated, like I don't need an updated business card. So I love connecting with people there. Sarah Gallagher, I'll come up if you search for me. Also, you can reach me on my email address, which I'm happy to give, my professional email address, which is Sarah Gallagher. Gallagher is 3 3-letter words, gal, lag, and her. My husband told me that when I married into the name, right?
Good one.
At thepersimmongroup.com, and persimmon is P-E-R-S-I-M-M-O-N.
Excellent.
Like the fruit.
Sarah, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Absolutely. This was such a pleasure. I'll do it every year you ask me. This is so much fun.
Good.